from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The military objective in Syria, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee yesterday, is to hold the Assad regime accountable, degrade its ability to carry out these kinds of attacks, and deter them from further use of chemical weapons. Could you drive a truck through that language? Could you go to war? Is it just right or too much, even as narrowly articulated? Now Congress has to decide. This hour On Point, Congress and the authorization question over Syria. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Should Congress green light this intervention? Where will it end? What do you see in the new political battle lines over this a dozen years after the invasion of Iraq? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Is this like Iraq? Is this like Afghanistan? Before the meeting with congressional leaders about Syria that he had yesterday, President Obama said no.
This is not Iraq, and this is not Afghanistan. This is a limited, proportional step that will send a clear message not only to the Assad regime, but also to other countries that may be interested in testing some of these international norms, that there are consequences.
A code pink protester at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where Secretary of State John Kerry spoke yesterday, wasn't having it.
We need to have health care, education, our country. Kerry, no more war in Syria.
A lot of legislators on Capitol Hill are not so sure either. Joining us first today from Washington is Jonathan Martin, national political correspondent for The New York Times. Jonathan Martin, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What do you see unfolding at this point? There's a lot of talk here about scrambled lines. People who a decade ago were hawks now having become non-interventionists or doves or isolationists. What's going on? What do you see coming?
This will shock you and your listeners, but there may be some politics at work here.
Maybe.
You know, I think the reason that the partisan lines have been scrambled is because of who's in the White House. You know, Democrats, who are traditionally a much more dovish party, who were obviously leading the charge against the Iraq war when George W. Bush was president, are facing considerable pressure from both the president and from leader Nancy Pelosi in the House to get behind this resolution. At the same time, the Republicans, typically the hawkish party, are expressing some grave reservations about intervening in Syria. So it does seem to be a bit backwards, but again, that's because of the politics of this. If you look at the polling data, there is, not much appetite among Republicans and the grassroots to support this intervention. And I think you're seeing that reflected in the comments from a lot of House members. The Senate, Tom's a bit different. It's more of a moderate body. Obviously, they're up for election every 6 years. They're not facing the constant threat of a re-election or of a primary, more to the point. So I think the lift is very much going to be in the House, and it's going to be a real challenge for Leader Pelosi because I don't think there's going to be a lot of GOP votes in the House for this. Yes, Speaker Boehner and Leader Keener came out yesterday for it, but they made very clear that they're not going to spend much capital trying to get their members out. So I think a big part of this burden is going to be on the shoulders of Nancy Pelosi and President Obama trying to move otherwise liberal members of the House to support this intervention.
I want to dig into your angle on this. It's really interesting. Here's Boehner yesterday saying he's on board.
This is something that the United States as a country needs to do. I'm going to support the president's call for action. I believe that my colleagues should support this call for action.
And the Democratic leader, Nancy Pelosi, is saying we must respond.
I am hopeful, as the American people are persuaded, that this action happened, that Assad did it, that hundreds of children were killed. This is behavior outside the circle of civilized human behavior, and we must respond.
Okay, there's everybody at the top saying we've got to support the president here, but we've heard a lot of talk about, wait a minute, we don't want to get involved in a new thing, and a lot of talk about neo-isolationism, that wing of the GOP.
Right.
I mean, I don't want to be, shocked, but are you saying the Rand Paul line on this is all theater, just covering an anti-Obama
No, look, I think that that's partly the case. You can never remove politics entirely from a Washington debate. And there's no question that some folks in the Republican Party would support this if it was President George W. Bush who was pushing it.
Yeah.
That said, you also can't take away policy. There is an ascendant movement in the Republican Party towards a more libertarian-leaning line on foreign policy. Look, I think Rand Paul's message was catching on well before the Syria debate, which is, you know, what business does America have entangling itself in these foreign affairs? And I think that has probably gotten more positive feedback because it's happening under a Democratic president. But I think it's not just politics. It's also the fact that there is a war weariness among a lot of GOP activists who have seen what's happened in Afghanistan and Iraq over the last decade and are not antsy to commit troops again to the front lines. So I think politics, absolutely a part of this, but there is a genuine and legitimate growing sort of, I don't know if you want to call it isolationist or non-interventionist movement within the Republican Party. And this is really a big opportunity for Rand Paul to move the center of his party on foreign policy to that more non-interventionist line.
Between Democrats who don't want to do this again or even risk right. Doing it again, quote unquote, and
right.
this sort of a neo-isolationist or non-interventionist Republican movement,
right.
How strong? What do the numbers look like? You're suggesting
right.
the president can have the Senate. Can he have the House? Can he finally get the imprimatur of Congress?
Well, you got to get 218 votes in the House. And look, you know, how many Republican votes are there? There are there 80? Are there 100? Oh my goodness, it's hard to see that right now. So again, this is why it's a fascinating political storyline to talk about the Republican split, and the split is real. But I think this is going to come down to some heavy lifting by Nancy Pelosi and by the administration because of the fact that you're going to see a lot of Republicans oppose this measure. They're going to have to get some real liberals to support this intervention. It's going to be fascinating to see the pressure, the horse trading on Democratic members of the House to support this, who were very vociferously against, the Iraq war.
Give us the Boehner political calculation here. I mean, he's sure. publicly out there saying he supports the president.
Sure.
Let's pass this. But you say he is not likely to spend much political capital on that,
right.
which suggests he would be all right if it didn't pass. How would John Boehner calculate the knock-on effect of a failure to pass this, a failure to support the president in his call for military intervention here?
I think the most telling part of what Boehner and Cantor said yesterday was when their aides put out a statement saying that this was a, quote, conscience vote. Now, Tom, a conscience vote is a euphemism
yeah.
for we're not going to whip this
thing.
Exactly. We're not going to, aggressively try to persuade our rank and file to support this. And that is a signal to the rank and file that, they're not going to face pressure from their leaders to do this. Now, putting aside that fact— even if Boehner and Cantor wanted to spend capital,
yeah.
as we've seen over the course of the last year or so, pressure from leaders in American politics and certainly in yeah. the House GOP is not as powerful as it once was.
But play that through. If they yeah. okay, Speaker Boehner and says it's a conscience vote.
Right.
And then it doesn't pass the House. Then it doesn't pass with a lot of Republicans sitting on their hands. And now
right.
we come to elections down the road, 2014, 2016.
Right.
He must be playing it through. How does he see it playing out? He doesn't think it's necessary to support the president here. If they don't go for it, how do you think Boehner's calculating the political implications of that for
right.
his party, the GOP?
Well, he is betting that looking at the polling data, Republicans, Democrats, independents who are showing little appetite for this intervention, that there's not going to be a political blowback in 2014 or 2016 if his party does not approve this. So, I mean, I think he's seeing the numbers out there and is, in his mind, doing the right thing and supporting the president on national security. But I don't think he is, staying up at night about it, given the fact that, the data shows that Americans aren't there.
Is there resistance here? Take the political piece out. I mean, it
yeah.
never goes away. But
right.
is there resistance because people, A, don't believe the evidence of a chemical attack by the Assad regime, or don't want support a punitive strike, or they fear that a punitive strike inevitably turns into something bigger, longer, deeper, swampier?
Oh, I think it's mostly the last prospect that you mentioned there, Tom. The country, again, I had a smart strategist say, you know, we've gone through crisis after crisis over the last decade, economic, national security, natural disasters. Yep. The list goes on and on. And I think the country is just weary, both parties, in the prospect of one more, you know, military intervention in a country where most Americans don't see where there's a direct security threat. And it's a hard sell. You know, the economy has made progress, but it's still not in great shape. I think most Americans are focused on their own prospects. And without a direct national security threat, you know, this is one more tragedy in a foreign land to a lot of Americans that doesn't affect their lives directly.
Do you think this president, Jonathan Martin, would go ahead and do this without the congressional authorization that he's now asked for if he fails to get it?
Well, I think that's the big question of the moment. They have said over and over again that they don't have to have it to do it. But they're being very, very careful about saying that he would, in fact, go forward with strikes if he doesn't have this authorization, which is why, by the way, they had this vote not this week, but next week. They need that time, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Congress and the intervention authorization on Syria, the political, strategic, moral battle lines on Capitol Hill. Jonathan Martin, national political correspondent for The New York Times, is with us today from Washington. We'll hear from more in just a moment. Here's the president today in Stockholm telling reporters that going to Congress with his proposal for limited intervention in Syria does not, as some have suggested, threaten his credibility if he doesn't get it.
My credibility is not on the line. The international community's credibility is on the line. And America and Congress's credibility is on the line because we give lip service to the notion that these international norms are important.
Well, we'll see whose credibility is on the line here. Jonathan Martin, please stand by there in Washington. With us right now from New Brunswick, New Jersey, Ross Baker, congressional historian and political science professor at Rutgers University, served as a senior advisor to Senator Chuck Hagel back in the day and Patrick Leahy back in 2000. Ross Baker, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So you know politics and you know history here. Do you see a precedent in American history for what we're looking at right now between the White House and Capitol Hill on not war exactly, but definitely significant military action?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that certainly if you go back to the period just before World War II, in 1940, the president, in the midst of a presidential campaign, prevailed upon Congress to pass a conscription act. And it said that there would be a selective service system and that people could be drafted for a period of a year. Well, after a year, the United States was still not at war. The soldiers who were in various bases, mostly in the South, were practically in a state of mutiny because they didn't have proper equipment. There was not a war to fight and so on. They were suffering from boredom. But the Conscription Act had a one-year deadline on it, which meant that after a year, these soldiers would have to be returned to civilian life. And the president had to go to Congress to get it extended. And it was a very, very difficult thing to do. And in fact, it's arguable, at least, that the parliamentary chicanery on the part of Sam Rayburn, the Speaker of the House, was the only thing that got it through. And I think the president was faulted at the time, and I think really quite justifiably, for really not explaining to the American people satisfactorily why this was necessary. He finally did come around and gave a national speech, and it did boost his public opinion rating and support for the extension of the Conscription Act. But I think that's really a very interesting kind of historical parallel. It goes way back, of course, but it's one I think that the president might well ponder.
But that was FDR looking for kind of infrastructure for war, readiness for war. Here we have a president calling for military action explicitly, directly, and imminently.
Right.
Has Congress ever denied an American president a request like this once he put it out there?
No, it's kind of interesting, Tom, because I think the feeling is that somehow people feel reassured when the president goes to Congress and gets authorization. I mean, the President Johnson went to Congress in 1964 after the Pleiku attacks and the attacks on the U.S. Warships, allegedly, in the Gulf of Tonkin. Congress authorized the United States to strike back against North Vietnam. Now, we know a lot of that information was false, that the intelligence was cooked. Similarly, in 2002, President Bush went to Congress again to get authorization act militarily against Iraq based upon what we now know to be false information. So the fact that the Congress is being asked to do these things doesn't guarantee success and doesn't guarantee that the outcome is going to be desirable.
Peter King, Republican, is saying that President Obama shouldn't have asked at all, that it undermines the authority of the commander-in-chief to come to Congress for this kind of authorization. What do you say?
Well, I think that Congressman King has something there. I think, it's now become commonplace to say, don't ask permission, ask for forgiveness. And I think perhaps when presidents do that, they're most successful, and there are innumerable examples of the president just going ahead on the flimsiest kind of legal basis, ranging from President Ford trying to recapture the ship Mayaguez in 1974. In 1986, President Reagan attacking Libya because of Libyan implication in the bombing of a nightclub in Berlin in which American soldiers were killed. All of these things were done without congressional approval. President Clinton, with a rather flimsy excuse from a result of a NATO resolution, bombing Bosnia in 1996. Kinds of things, I think, were examples of presidents taking the initiative under, I think, a well-established historical precedent that the president's commander-in-chief really can deploy the armed forces of the United States. And what I find interesting, Tom, is the fact that if, in fact, Congress does refuse to give him the resolution and President Obama goes ahead and attacks these sites in Syria, I would bet any amount of money that there would be an immediate impeachment resolution introduced by some Republican in the House of Representatives.
Of course, we almost had that before any of this really came up, just
That's
on the basis
right.
of I don't know. Jonathan Martin's with us, and he says the outcome in the House is very uncertain. How do you read this, Ross? Where do you see Congress ultimately going?
I think it is uncertain, and I think, Tom, this may be a study in subtraction rather than addition as far as votes are concerned. If you subtract the code pink wing of the Democratic Party in the House and subtract the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party in the House, you have a fairly narrow collection of people in the middle, many of whom remain unpersuaded. So I think it really is a crapshoot.
Jonathan, what do you say?
What's so fascinating about this vote is that it's also a commentary, as Ross well knows, because he's a really sharp scholar on American politics. It also is a commentary on the state of the U.S. House and the American political system and just how polarized the House has become as a reflection of a polarized country. Look, the House, as Ross mentioned, does not have much of a middle. You've got Democrats from big cities, from college towns, and from some inner suburbs, and you've got a lot of Republicans from rural areas and from outer suburbs, and there's not a lot in between. And so because of that, and because of the so-called great sort that's happened in American politics and culture, there's not much of a sort of internationalist wing, the sort of Arthur Vandenberg, Harry Truman bipartisan approach to foreign policy. It just doesn't exist really in the U.S. House. I think you'll find some folks in the middle, but again, the work that Pelosi, Obama, and Boehner have in front of them here is really considerable to find support for a military intervention after the last decade of war against the backdrop of a country that across the board has no appetite for it.
Let's go to Paul in Des Moines, Iowa. The calls are really coming in here. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a former soldier in the U.S. Army, and I got to tell you, I'm reminded of where we were 10 years ago this month. When things were starting to go really bad in Iraq. And I think even though Iraq is not the same situation as Syria, I think that's why there's going to be very little public support for this initiative for the president.
Because you don't believe it will be restricted to a short, sharp intervention and out?
I think it could be. I think it could be, but here's the problem. The public's not going to see it that way. The public was 10 years ago, we were told how quick we'd be in and out, how quick everything was going to go, and then all of a sudden, it turned on us. And now, again, we're going in saying, even though I firmly believe the intelligence on this, we're once again saying we've got ironclad evidence.
Yeah.
It's going to be a quick situation.
Yeah, and the country pauses. Paul, I appreciate your call. Jonathan, is this the legacy of George W. Bush and the entrance into Iraq and everything that followed, all that pain? Is that what's playing out here in part?
Oh, that's a huge factor, and certainly was the driving factor over in the UK, which explained why Parliament opposed this. And it's certainly in the back of people's minds here. I think that, to a large extent, is driving this libertarianism on foreign policy in the Republican Party that we talked about. And certainly among Democrats, it's the first thing that they think of when they're asked about another Middle East intervention. It was the sort of determinative fact in the 08 Democratic primary between President Obama and then Senator Clinton. And I think it still looms large in the American political psyche, especially among members of Congress.
I want to ask both of you about a strangeness that I can't sort out very easily here. On the one hand, there's a lot of push in Congress for very clearly delineated limits to this intervention, maybe 90 days and all, limit it, so it doesn't turn into Iraq. On the other hand, we saw John McCain and Lindsey Graham come out of their meeting with the president in the White House expressing new, fresh, great confidence that there was a bigger plan here, that this was going to go beyond just a slap on the wrist, that this was going to get at the real issues, and even in the Civil War. So what's going on? Is there one thing before Congress but a side agreement about some other bigger intervention? We're hearing now about not just the CIA but the U.S. military maybe coming in to do more training of rebels in Syria. Is there a side agreement, Jonathan, that you could drive a Mack truck through?
Well, that's exactly the fear of a lot of doves or a lot of sort of skeptics, I should say, in both parties. And that is they just don't believe the fact that this is going to be a limited 60-day air operation where we're basically launching Tomahawk missiles from ships, and that there is going to inevitably be more engagement, more involvement, if not direct U.S. troops on the ground, certainly helping to arm or supply the rebels, and we're going to get sucked in further and further and further. That is exactly the fear and the hesitation of it. At the same time, though, going back in the other direction, the hawks like John McCain and Lindsey Graham, that's exactly what they're hoping happens. You know, to them, what's the point of launching cruise missiles to quote unquote send a message if Assad is still going to be there and if he still has the capacity to gas his people again? You know, why aren't we doing in their minds? Why aren't we trying to do regime change to try to change fundamentally what's happening in the country?
I mean, there was this interesting exchange yesterday. Secretary of State Kerry before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I'm sure you heard it, Jonathan and Ross. And there's some confusion caused by this. The question was kind of put, if Syria were to go into complete chaos or chemical weapons, what risk of falling into the hands of a militant group like al-Nusra, Islamist rebels there? The Secretary of State said he would not abandon any possibility.
I don't want to take off the table an option that might or might not be available to the President of the United States to secure our country.
Which sounded like maybe, who knows, a boots-on-the-ground option. Asked later to clarify by Republican Senator Bob Corker, here's Kerry again saying he was only talking about a hypothetical case, not reality. No boots on the ground, said Kerry.
The answer is, whatever prohibition clarifies it to Congress and the American people, there will not be American boots on the ground with respect to the Civil War.
Ross Baker, can he credibly make that promise in this context?
Well, I think that after the president's conversation with Senators McCain and Graham, and after the somewhat ambiguous, even clarified statement by Secretary of State Kerry, I think there's a fear among some people that we're going to become incrementally pregnant, that somehow we're under the guise of a quick surgical strike, that ultimately we're going to migrate into something much more ambitious that's going to keep us there for a good long while. The president's argument about how vital this is to American national security sounds a little bit like a domino effect. argument. That is, well, you know, although we are not directly affected by this, well, you know, Israel might be, or Turkey might be, and so on. A lot of hypotheticals when I think people really don't want to go to war over hypotheses.
I mean, we've got this, the news just coming out here that we've got a Senate resolution now that's being put forward by Bob Menendez of New Jersey and Bob Corker of New Jersey, Tennessee. Puts a 90-day limit on U.S. action and says no American troops can be sent into Syria. And John McCain, now asked about that, saying, could he support it? He says in its current form, he does not, would not support that. I mean, Jonathan, could this just devolve into a giant mess here?
Well, that's what I was speaking to a minute ago, and that is the skeptics here in both parties worry that there's going to be mission creep, invariably, to use Ross's very colorful phrase, we're going to become incrementally pregnant. But the hawks like McCain worry that we're not doing enough, that we're only going to do a sort of limited strike over a set number of days. So that is also a looming threat here, which is the two extremes combined to ultimately kill a narrow authorization, that the skeptics are big enough combined with the hardcore hawks who are not going to support a narrow authorization, that they could combine to form a coalition that would actually undermine passage.
Let's go to Kit in Sandusfield, Massachusetts. Kit, you're on the air.
On Point is the best program on NPR. I listen every day. Thank you for your program.
Sure.
The president really, despite Harry Truman's "the buck stops here," the president has passed the buck here. And now he's going to blame the Congress. Either way they vote, he's dumped this in the Congress. And it's a sinister move, and he's off the hook, because either way they vote, he'll blame the Congress.
Sinister to go to Congress and ask their approval? I mean, you know, Kit, that many times that the president doesn't go, people have been up in arms, including Barack Obama back in the day, not to mention Joe Biden. But let us look at that. Ross, against the pattern of history, was it fair for the president to ask Congress to sanction this?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that the president is seeking political cover, that greatest of all political commodities, which is that members of Congress will have to go on record. They will have a vote that will be used either for them or against them. And I understand from a political point of view, I mean, Jonathan pointed out that, you know, the importance of the political element here. I think clearly having to put members of Congress on record is useful to the president. I think that it makes a lot of members of Congress uncomfortable. They don't like to go on record.
Yeah, sure. So call it for us, Ross. Here we are. Maybe a week from now there'll be a vote. How do you think it's going to go, up or down?
My feeling is it probably will narrowly pass, but very narrowly. And it may involve the kind of political chicanery that Sam Rayburn resorted to in 1941.
And if it shouldn't pass, will the United States just stand down on Syria and its alleged chemical attacks?
My guess is the president's going to go ahead on his own.
Anyway.
Yep.
I mean, how would that make him look against the lessons of history, the Constitution, you name it?
Well, I mean, if in fact he's concerned about the stature of the United States in the eyes of the world, if in fact he sees an international norm being violated, if in fact he, as he did say, a red line was crossed, I think he would look rather helpless and ineffective if he did nothing.
But which stature? You know, stature as a policeman, stature as a democracy. Wow. You think he'd go anyway. Ross Baker, it's great to have you with us, author of House and Senate and the New Fat Cats. Thank you very much for joining us, Ross.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour at Congress and the intervention authorization question on Syria, the battle lines on Capitol Hill. Jonathan Martin, national political correspondent for The New York Times, is with us, co-author of The End of the Line, Romney versus Obama, the 34 days that decided the election. Just out of Politico, over the Times now, great reporter, good eye, great eye on Washington. Yesterday, talking with Republican Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, Secretary of State John Kerry defended the president's plan for limited intervention, said it was in the interest of American people. If Americans were asked if they wanted to go to war in Syria, he said it would be a no.
Of course not. Everybody, 100% of Americans will say no. We say no. We don't want to go to war in Syria either. It's not what we're here to ask. The president is not asking you to go to war. He's not asking you to declare war. He's not asking you to send one American troop to war. He's simply saying we need to take an action that can degrade the capacity of a man who's been willing to kill his own people by breaking a nearly 100-year-old prohibition? And will we stand up and be counted to say we won't do that?
Degrade that capacity. That's a word that's getting a lot of attention here. How deep, how far, how long even? Rand Paul responding here. What if the government, the White House, doesn't get the green light from Congress? He's asking Secretary of State Kerry.
Secretary Kerry, stand up for us and say, you're going to obey the Constitution, and if we vote you down, which is unlikely, by the way, but if we do, you would go with what the people say through their Congress, and you wouldn't go forward with a war that your Congress votes against.
And there we stand. Jonathan Martin's with us from Washington, and from Washington as well right now, Thomas Mann, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, co-author with Norm Ornstein of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. They also wrote The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track. Thomas Mann, thank you very much for being with us today.
Tom, delighted to be back with you.
What do you see unfolding here, and where do you think it's going?
I think in the end, the president will get a very differently worded resolution authorizing the use of force in Syria. I think he asked for it for a number of reasons, but most importantly, frankly, was his concern about the lack of international and domestic support for response to the use of chemical weapons, as frankly, as well as his own long-time reluctance to intervene. He thought this was an opportunity, actually, because of divisions among Republicans, to actually get Congress to take something up outside of a purely partisan opposition. And in fact, I think Speaker Boehner and Leader Cantor's support really are quite significant. And I would say with Pelosi doing her informal whipping, with Boehner and Cantor providing support, with the pro-Israeli forces working hard, and the existence of some GOP hawks, including some very conservative representatives from Kansas and Arkansas, I think in the end, the House will pass a resolution.
And the Senate, and off we go. Jonathan Martin says, don't expect Boehner and Cantor to twist any arms, really, here, Thomas.
They don't have to. They're providing some, it seems to me, some cover. But even more importantly, look at the difference between what's going on here and what's happening on the budget and the economy. In the on the latter, it's hopeless. Boehner is away from mid-forces and has decided to play brinksmanship with the debt ceiling and stick with a destructive sequester because the forces within his party are pushing him to do it. He knows it will hurt the national reputation of the party. But on this, there's no question. There will be an up or down vote in the House. He will not abide by a Hastert rule requiring a majority of Republicans. And in the Senate, there will be no filibuster. This is high stakes, up or down, prominent Republicans who are on record as supporting it. And in the end, I think with Pelosi and Hoyer and Chris Van Hollen, with an authorization written much more narrowly, which doesn't bother Barack Obama one bit. He's not inclined to do it. I think it's doable. Tom, it's worth remembering that the last time a president asked for approval from Congress for an action, really, and failed to get it was in 1917 with Woodrow Wilson trying to arm American-owned merchant vessels to counter German U-boats.
Yeah, way back.
Lusitania.
And off we go.
Then used some other authority to go forward. But within a month, Congress declared war on Germany. if this would be highly unusual when the stakes get this high and there are natural divisions within the opposition party.
Yep.
Even though you know it's tough and it will be close, you'd bet with passage.
Kerry says no war, but get the guns in there now. Jonathan Martin, which part you're not so confident this is going to pass in the House? Which part of Thomas Mann's calculus don't you see as delivering? You know, a Baker Cantor cover, or the Hawks there, or the Israel lobby, or Pelosi coming along?
Right. I think that I'm with Tom in the sense that I think by next week it could happen. I think right now it's unlikely, but I think between now and next week the votes could be there because, yeah, sure, there is a natural, on such a major issue, a sort of natural tendency to rally. But keep in mind, though, when President Clinton in 1999, launched missiles at Kosovo, look at the amount of House Republicans. And again, similar dynamic, a lot of conservatives who had come in the House class of 94, a very conservative House, GOP majority. Look at the amount of Republicans who voted against that. And again, that was not in the aftermath of a decade of war. So I think it's going to be hard to get those Republican votes. Yes, you'll find some hawks that are there. I just think their numbers are few and far between. I think that Tom's key point, though, is what Pelosi, Hoyer, and Van Hollen, three of the top Democrats, what they can get done, and what with President Obama and Vice President Biden, how many House Democrats they can move. You're going to have a lot of liberal doves supporting this intervention because they want to be on the side of the president. One last fast point, and that is this would probably be easier for President Obama and Leader Pelosi if there were still earmarks. But there's no earmarks anymore.
To spread the favors around.
It's exactly right.
By the votes.
A bridge here, a road there.
Yeah.
That's not available anymore. So President Obama may actually have to play some golf with members of Congress here because he needs to find some kind of leverage, some kind of promises to House Democrats to get their votes.
I want to look back at that authorization language. We've got listeners waiting here. Jack in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Jack, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking this call. The American people are told that America can't afford its commitments to its poor. America cannot afford its commitments to its elderly. And America cannot provide jobs or even decent treatment of its own troops coming home from war. I can't imagine how this country can act as though it still has the resources to do anything anywhere outside of this country.
You and a lot of other people scratching their heads over, Jack, you are scarcely alone in that. I want to look at that, and if I may, let's add one more. This is a comment from the website. Jack, thank you for that. We will go to it. JP writes on the web, we put over 100,000 boots on the ground in Iraq, right next door to Syria. We completely destroyed the government of the dictator Saddam Hussein. We hung Saddam. Why wasn't this enough deterrence to prevent Assad from doing what he's doing? Thomas Mann.
Listen, America still has a big economy. It plays a singular role in world affairs.
But all we hear about is our deficit and what we cannot do. But this comes up and we're told we can do it. And what about the lesson next door? If these things are so important to get to teach lessons and uphold lessons, Saddam used chemical weapons. We didn't mind it first. We finally went in. We hung him. And that wasn't enough of an example.
Listen, if you're looking for consistency and wisdom on all past decisions, I can't provide that to you. I think Iraq was a mistake, and I think we've made big mistakes in the past. But this notion now that we can't afford to do anything else is a self-inflicted one. If we didn't have a no new tax pledge, and if we're willing to act intelligently with our social insurance programs, we have big enough budgets to do the kind of effort that Obama's talking about here. I'm not claiming that this is an easy call or a clear call at all. I think Syria is a mess, and nothing is, in the end, going to turn it into a victory anytime soon. But we're trying to minimize damage for the international norms of the use of weapons of mass destruction and for the kind of chaos developing and spreading in the Middle East. There are no good answers there. This is probably a case where a circumscribed intervention and then assistance to the Free Syrian Army will be the extent of our involvement. But if America, it seems to me, gets overly attracted to a kind of neo-isolationism that we had back in the 40s, then we're in for big trouble. And I think that's why this vote will have very high stakes. And I think in the end, that's why it will pass. And listen, the public opinion's reaction to this will be determined on how long it goes on, how successful or unsuccessful it is. Sure, all of us are war weary and skeptical, but in the end, it's the ultimate outcome that matters so much, and not the state of opinion right now.
Well, hard choice on all sides. Looking at Congress and the Syria question, Jonathan Martin, our caller says, "Hey, I thought we were told we were broke. I mean, we've got a giant budget debate coming up that Republicans will push very hard, and Democrats will represent their view very hard. We have this sequester that's been cutting right and left in this country. Does the cost of an intervention even come up here? I mean, you know, a month from now, we're going to be talking budget like crazy. Is it in the middle of this now?"
Oh, I think it absolutely will come up. And by the way, I think you could see some hawks in the House ranks of the Republicans who vote against this on the grounds that the country can't afford it, given the sequester. Keep a close eye on the House Armed Services Committee Chairman Buck McKeon,
mm-hmm.
Who is certainly a hawk, who does have some real authority with his members on the committee. He's been screaming about the sequester for some time now. And I think people like him, if they do oppose this, are going to point to the cost and say, you know, we can't be having these deep cuts in the military and at the same time expecting them to, you know, engage in yet another conflict.
Wanda in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Wanda, thanks for calling. You're on.
I have to question, as a civilization, not just America, but as a civilization, have we forgotten 75 years ago when a dictator gassed his people? And we were asked by Britain to enter the conflict, and we turned him down until we lost so many lives at Pearl Harbor. And then
you're talking Hitler and Nazi Germany. Okay.
You know, as a civilization, as a world people, should we even be debating this?
What? Your answer is no. If there's the red line was right the way the president originally drew it, and we should be there, you're saying?
I don't think as we elected whatever was not right or was right. He is the president. He does have commanding powers. Can we even all look at ourselves in the mirror if we don't act? I mean, you know, are we going to let another Holocaust and another Hitler come about because he wanted to gas his own people because he didn't like their religion?
I mean, you know, we've already... Rwanda happened, and we watched. 100,000 people have already died. Yes, there's a different element here, and it's gas, and it's terrible in those images. But there's the moral argument, and I have no doubt we'll hear more of that. Let me try and grab one more call. Thank you, Wanda. Susan in Danvers, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm happy for the process that is taking place here, and that is that the president is attempting to make his case, and now it's time for the American people to speak up and have their voices heard, because the foreign policy of the United States does not belong to the president or to the Congress. It belongs to the people. And so I'm expecting that the press is going to do a better job in getting some more information in here about where exactly the chemical weapons may have come from.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the world will have a chance to weigh in on this and perhaps more pictures and evidence and photographs so that the entire international community can join us.
If that, Susan, if that evidence is persuasive and persuasive to you, what are you saying to your congressperson? Go or no go?
Well, I haven't received enough evidence yet to say yes, and I haven't received enough information yet to say no, and that's why I think the press has got to do
a better job in providing us information. I think the president does as well. But the foreign policy of the United States belongs to us.
Well, there's the careful citizen deliberation and asking for more information. Jonathan, have we rushed past the evidence part, or do you think that's still an active element here, uncertainty on the actual evidence?
I think it's very much an active element, and I think it could actually be one of the crucial elements in the course of the next week in the administration's effort to lobby members of Congress, the closed-door intelligence briefings where they're going to present the case to them that we're not going to hear much about publicly, I think could be really pivotal with trying to convince a lot of the skeptics to vote yes.
So I'm looking here, breaking news that a senior UN diplomat says that inspection teams report analysis is going to be sped up, should be done in 2 or 3 weeks. But by that time, everybody expects this vote to have taken place. So we shall see. Thomas Mann at the Brookings Institution, it's always great to have you. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Happy to be with you, Tom.
And Jonathan Martin, national political correspondent for the New York Times. You're very generous with your time and your insights. It's always great to have you join us, Jonathan. Thanks so much.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being with us today. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.